Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. I am really excited tonight for tonight's show because I'm really, really honored to have a group that was part of my growing up and my musical influence, one of the influences for me, the Strawberry Alarm Clock. And I have most of the band. I think I have pretty. I mean, there's a lot of different members over the years that have been in here, but everybody's here, so it's a real honor to have everybody here. Let me introduce everybody. On bass, George Bunnell, and Gene Gunnels on drums. Randy Sill on percussion and drums. Mark Weitz on keyboard. And Howie, Howrad Anderson on guitar. So, everybody, welcome to the show. There we go. I got all the mics open now.
Look out.
So, we got everybody in here. And I'll welcome. It's great to have. It's an honor to have you guys all here.
Thanks, Jim.
What I will do, let me see, where am I getting the hum? That's very interesting. Okay. That's what it is. Okay. Actually,
wow.
We don't
very
need,
impressive, Jeff.
We don't need that mic, so we're good. All right. No, we're good. Thank you guys for coming on the show. I'm going to open up with their hit that was their big hit back in 1967, Incense and Peppermints. And let's play that, and then I'm going to pick your brains on it because I do want to know what was used on that song. So this is a gear show, so I'm going to, especially Howie, you're under the gun now. There's a lot of pressure.
There is.
So anyway, here's Incense and Peppermints, and take a listen. This is a great song.
Mankind, dead kings, many things I can't define. Old Cajun spots, wagons, blood to your mind. Incense and peppermints, the color of time.
Who cares what games we choose? Little to win, but nothing to lose.
Incense and peppermints, meaningless mounds. Turn on, tune in, turn your eyes around.
Look what you saw. Look at your song.
I love that fuzz tone. That just brings back memories of. But what was that? What was that?
That is Jeff. The fuzz we just talked about. The maestro.
The maestro fuzz.
Maestro tone. Fuzz. I remember Julie. She's one of the co-owners of Earthquaker Pedals. She mm-hmm. knows in the Strawberry Alarm Clock. I've become really good friends with them. And she goes, Howie, I need you to. One of my clients wants to know what fuzz was used on that, and I said, I don't know. I'll find out. So I you know, instant messaged Ed King and said, Ed, what fuzz was that? And he told me, and you know, the maestro. And I said, wow, there wasn't that many choices back then, right, for fuzzes. And he said that was the only one.
Yeah.
That's it. End of story.
Yeah, well, yeah. I know some of the stuff that sounded like fuzz tone. I was talking with Mark before because we talked about the fact that you guys had toured with Buffalo Springfield, and there was a sound that I had interviewed Jimmy Messina, and I mm-hmm. said, how did he get that fuzz tone? And it's like, no, it wasn't a fuzz tone; it was a Marshall full up.
Yeah,
you
right,
know,
right.
But also too, considering that sound of this, the lead on this song, Mark, you told me a little story that I think about with Randy Bachman. I think you should share that.
That was me.
Oh, I'm sorry, George.
That was George.
That was me. My other band that I'm in called Grey Dog, we opened for Randy Bachman at the Saban Theater. And this was fairly recent, like a year ago. And he said, and Alan, our guitar player, introduced me as being from Strawberry Alarm Clock to mm-hmm. Randy Bachman. We were standing on stage with him. And he goes, oh, he goes, that's awesome. He goes, well, he goes, my sound on American Woman I got from Ed King's sound. And he goes, mm-hmm. look over there in front of my amp and look what you'll see. And sure enough, there was the maestro fuzz tone and everything that Ed would have used. And I said, I have to text Ed a picture of this. And he goes, oh, really? And I said, yeah. And so I cool. did. I took a picture of it, texted it to Ed, and I told Ed that I was standing there with Randy Bachman and that he modeled his sound on American Woman after Incense and Peppermints' guitar solo. And Ed wrote back, you know, you're kidding me. Actually, he said something different. But it was really funny. So I sent him back a picture of me with Randy Bachman, and Ed loved it.
That's great. I mean, it just goes to show the influence that you guys have had in a lot of the music, because you were right in that scene, what was happening at the time. You guys were all, it was right there. I mean, you toured with, like we said, the Buffalo Springfield and the Beach Boys. You guys were all recording in the same recording mm-hmm. studios. And I want to post this out there too, to ask a question, which I was talking with you guys before the show. There was, because at that time, like, the Beach Boys were using the Wrecking Crew. They were hiring musicians, even though they played live. And we talked a little earlier, but was there any pressure for you guys to use the Wrecking Crew? Because a lot of the record companies didn't really like, you know, like with the Birds. Well, they never got to play.
Right.
What I remember is that we were pretty proud that we played everything on our first album and our second album. We mm-hmm. had no outside musicians. There was a rumor going around that
we had one, Steve Bartek.
Oh, well,
he played flute on our first album.
Yeah, but I mean, comparatively,
he was part of the band.
99%. I mean, we played it. Everything.
Right, but was he doing sessions back then, or was he?
Yeah.
No,
he was too.
No.
Yeah, he was only 15.
He was a baby.
Yeah,
no,
he came in and recorded with us.
He sure. came in and recorded with us, and he wrote the songs with us. But
what I was trying to say was that for 17 and 18 year old guys, I thought, you know, we basically came up with these arrangements and played everything, contrary to what we had heard, like, out on the street that, oh, yeah, they're just singing and they brought in studio musicians. Uh-huh. I heard that rumor so many times I kind of got sick of it. But we played every note.
Yeah.
And one thing, when you were talking about the maestro fuzz tone, I wanted to say for you guitar geeks out there, Ed used an old Blonde Telecaster on that to play
those
cool. notes.
What did he use, Fender amps? Was he using?
You know, we... it's funny, shortly after we recorded that, we were Vox Amplifier Company sponsored us. So for a while there, we were playing through a Vox Super Beatles.
Oh, okay.
But as far as what Ed used then, I can't remember. But yeah, Fender was, I know our bass
but
player.
But when you guys did session work, you used Fenders. You didn't use the Voxes.
I remember.
No, we used a Vox too.
Really?
Yeah, no, yeah. We recorded a lot with Vox, especially on the first album and second album, I think.
Yeah.
I know we went on the road. We used to have three Super Beatles on stage.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And you were using a Vox organ?
Well, I started with the Farfisa Combo Compact.
That was used on
Incense and Peppermints and all through the first album. And then when Vox started sponsoring us, they had the Vox Continental, which a lot of the English groups were using, and I said, wow, this is cool, you know. So I kind of left the Farfisa in the dust, and I moved over to the Vox
Continental. But did the Vox give you that sound? I mean, that's a pretty distinctive opening to Incense and Peppermints.
Yeah. They're two totally different sounds.
Okay.
To some people, it would sound... The difference is subtle, but... to this day, I have a Vox Continental and a Farfisa, and I sometimes use both on stage because they have two different sounds. Sometimes I use a Farfisa if that craps out, because these are vintage keyboards
that
I have to keep my keyboard tech, Ken Rich, I have to keep him in business.
That's true.
Yeah. They're always going out on the road.
And you never used a Hammond.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
You did.
So in 69, I dragged around a B3 and 122 Leslie.
So you were using multiple keyboards back then?
No, actually, when I used the Hammond when we did our fourth album in 69, that was the only keyboard I used on stage.
Oh, okay.
The Hammond. Yeah.
So you always had just, you didn't stack them at that point?
No, I think sometimes I had, on the Hammond, I might have put one keyboard on top of the Hammond, but... For the first three albums, it was Farfisa, piano. I always overdubbed piano on top of the organ. Then we kind of achieved a mix. That was one of the secrets of recording the Italian organs, was that it was missing the mid-range tones. So when I would put in the piano, whether it was Baby Grand or upright or whatever, we would run it just below the radar, so you couldn't tell the piano was there, but yet it would fill that center frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So on Incense and Peppermints, it was an overdub of Farfisa and the piano, Baby Grand.
Did you use a piano live?
No, just in the last 2 years, we did one semi-unplugged show where I used a Baby Grand, and I enjoyed it.
Okay. But, no, that's cool. I'm just curious.
Unfortunately, when you're playing in venues where you're dealing with amplifiers, it's hard to play a Baby Grand piano.
Well, no, that's true. But I was wondering if you would have used a Rhodes or something like that.
No, I never made the switch to Rhodes. It was too soft and it wasn't funky sounding for our type of music.
Right.
I like the Rhodes sound, especially one that's been tweaked and really geeked out, but it wasn't our band.
Well, I'm going to play... I'm going to play a song because the reason I'm playing the whole thing is the arrangement. This is Tomorrow, which is on. There's three different versions of this. I'm playing the one that's on your album, Wake Up, It's Tomorrow. And
that was a stereo version, by the way.
Right.
The original was a mono on the 45.
And the vocals reminded me a lot of like the Association, and I forgot that in the 60s that was a big deal. Those layered vocals was a real important part of it. But there's a lot of stuff there. Listen to the organ, the vocals, how everything plays, and then I think there's a guitar with a fuzz, probably the maestro on there.
That was Ed King, yeah.
Yeah, so let me play this, and you can tell me a little more about the behind the scenes on this song, because it's an interesting... what I want to try to do is take a look and really understand that style. Because it's a very distinctive thing, you know. They called it psychedelic music, or what? I was looking on the Strawberry Alarm Clock Wikipedia, the Sunshine Pop, Acid Rock, whatever it was. But there was a distinctive style to it. It was different than some of the other things that were happening at the time, and it has its own little flavor to it. So let me play Tomorrow, and then we'll talk a little more about the arrangement. Here's Tomorrow.
Thank you.
I love that ending. That's yeah. just but again, you can hear again the vocals, the way the vocals are. I'll tell you right now, the way the bass line and then also the drums, it's obvious that it's different than the Wrecking Crew type of sound. It's a totally different. The lines are more. It reminds me more of some of the stuff that around that time, like McCartney was doing, and also some of the other bass players, like from the Moody Blues, where they were doing these kind of do 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 type of lines where they're going around, as opposed to you know, the Carol Kay style. They were more percussive right. with a pick, mm-hmm. and they were doing more rhythmical things. You're doing like runs in there, and it's the counterpoint. It moves it along.
Well, and, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ed played the bass on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing that you were starting to talk about, our sound, we were influenced a lot by the groups that were happening of the day back then.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that you may hear creep into some of our style, too.
Right. Well,
whether it was the UK, you know...
British sound, Invasion.
Yeah, British Invasion, or just the San Francisco sound. I mean, we're melding everything, you know, like shoving it through a funnel, and what was coming out was the sum total of all of our experiences in our musical, you know, journey of each guy in the band throwing it into the ring, and that's what was coming out of it. That's where we got our sound from.
Well, a lot of people, when I've tried to explain what I remember of the 60s, in because I was young, I was like 10 years old when it was happening, but the thing was, everybody was influenced by everybody else, and it was like anything worked. You could do anything you wanted, you know. So like, for example, with the Beatles, and you know, that with the Indian music, they threw that in. But like you were saying, in from San Francisco, there was a lot of other influences, whether it's blues or whether, you know, funk or whether, you know, whatever, with all of that stuff they were mixing and matching. And I notice on the albums too, on your albums, they're pretty diverse. We're going to play another clip in a little bit, totally different feel, but it was cool that you could do that. Whereas now, I think there's more pressure for you to stay in a format and be kind of pigeonholed.
We always thought it was one of the, you know, strong points of the band that we had a variety of different musical styles, because we had several people writing in the band, and mm-hmm. everybody wrote a little different, and everybody acquiesced to, if they wrote a song, we would try to do our best to support the song and play our best at their style. So we would have several different writers in the band. It wasn't like one person writing all the songs.
Right, right. And the songwriting power that you had a lot of resources with yourself and you know, Steve and you guys. I have to mention too, we were talking about this before the show, I was reading their bio and stuff, and Steve and Randy and George had written for ABC in Concert, the theme for that, which was a big, you know, the Don Kirshner thing, which was a big influence on me, because it was one of the best live performance things on TV where you could see groups. I remember one of the first ones for me was Edgar Winter, and it was just awesome, you know. But you guys are doing, I mean, you still are doing a lot of different things, and you've been in other projects and stuff, and it coming back together. It's interesting to see coming full circle. So, but you know, it was interesting that the musical potential, the arrangement of power of you guys, what you were doing, was pretty amazing. And then this cut, you're using that's the Vox, right?
Uh-huh.
On Tomorrow.
Yeah, on the Vox Continental on Tomorrow. I had switched from the Farfisa to the Vox Continental at that point. Just a little side note in the musical, quickly. If you at the end of Incense of Peppermints, we did the shalalas in major sevenths.
Mm-hmm.
It was E major seven, D major seven, C major, and then that repeated. And so when Uni after Incense of Peppermints became a number one hit, and we worked our tails off up and down the coast promoting that record, they said, "We need another Incense of Peppermints." So I said, you know, I don't think I can write another Incense of Peppermints, but I'll see what I can do. So it has to sound like it. So I took the major sevenths off the shalalas on the end of the song, and I started the song with it. Those were the three same chords that we sing at the end of the song. And that's where those came from. And then Ed King helped me with the bridge on it. And that song was on its way, way shorter in time. It was only 2 minutes and 20 seconds as opposed
to... Right, it's a quick...
Incense,
quick.
I think the original was like 3:05 or 3:15 or something like that, mm-hmm. which we almost didn't get on the air because our producer said you can't go over 3 minutes on a song.
Yeah, people don't remember that. That was a big... Or what the Beatles did is they recorded their songs and they sped them up. They sped them up a little. They would play them a little. So if you listen to your Beatle records, you were a little out of tune. You had to tune your guitar a little because they actually did on purpose speed them up a little bit. And a lot of radio stations were doing that a lot. But was that the Maestro fuzz on that lead?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have to guess on that. That's distinctly.
Because it's a great sound. And then we were talking about he holds the note at the end, and then you're. You're riding the reverb to bring it out to get it to sustain.
Yeah, when we were mixing it down on the stereo version, I reached over and I just took the slider on the reverb and I pushed it. As you hear the sustaining note, you hear it getting hollower and distant and more distant. And when it came to right at the end of the note where he released and slid down the string, I ran it back down to the bottom again.
It's a great effect.
Because it was expanding left to right on a full pan at that point, yeah.
Now, where did you guys record this was recorded where? At
TTG.
Yeah.
TTG?
Yeah.
Off now, the were you guys recording 4-track at that time?
No. Mm-mm. No, that was 16 on Tomorrow. Incense was 8.
Oh, it was 8-track, but
actually 10.
God, I'm trying
to
remember.
Actually, at George, he corrected himself. It is a 10-track machine. It was a one-of-a-kind. Paul Buff, the engineer on our first album, actually designed a 10-track machine.
A 10-track?
Yeah.
It's the only one.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to remember, in 60s, there wasn't too many multi-tracks back then.
No, they had a 4-track recorder right where we thought, you know, and then...
He
there
brought
was this
that
big
out.
2-inch tape, and we go, and what's that?
Oh, that's it had 2-inch, 10-track, 2-inch.
It was like giant.
Wow.
There's still big tracks. It's 2-inch.
Yeah, no, that's interesting back then.
Yeah, he was an innovator. In fact, last year I visited Ed King. We tried to go visit Paul Buff at White Lightning Studios in Nashville, and Paul had passed away. And it had just happened because the secretary, we didn't even go into the studio. So Paul had recently passed away, so we were... Sorry to hear that.
No, that's interesting. But there wasn't the others. Had you used any of the other studios? Because I don't think I remember doing a session at Sunset Sound. I was really young. It was we were over there, and it was like 67, 68.
It was Sunset Recorder, and then Sun West. I think we used also George.
They just got their first 8-track. It looked like a copy machine. It was huge, and they just took it out of the crate. And I remember talking to Don Randy about that, and he said, "Yeah, most of their stuff was 4-track, but that's interesting, a 10-track."
Yeah, and that's because of Paul Buff. He owned a company, or he started a company called Allison Electronics, and he invented the K-Pex. Which are the
now
things.
That's something you don't hear every day.
Yeah, Paul Buff he was a wizard. And he was so much fun in the studio. Like, if any of us, we were 18 years old. And, you know, usually people don't pay any attention to you if you say something. But he did. And so if we suggested something, he would go, oh, yeah, let's try that.
Yeah.
We even turned the tape backwards for one song and did reverse echo.
Very cool.
And, you know, just goofing around. You know, what would it sound like if you did this? And he'd go, well, let's find out. You know, it was like...
So you were doing, I mean, but you guys were, that wasn't too common.
No.
And like, for example, Hendrix was doing it later. It was happening more later. And there was a little bit of stuff in England that was being done, but that's interesting.
Yeah, you know, most groups didn't have their control of their own destiny, and we didn't either. We had a producer that was like a, you know, old school back then, Frank Slay. And he had, you know, done a bunch of things, and he was in part responsible for the Four Seasons, but and a bunch of other people. What was his name? Freddie Cannon. And
yeah, did he produced Freddie Cannon
and the Rays and a bunch of other people. And so he
Bob
had his
Crew generation.
He had these, you know, he was a really good producer, got a really good sound, he knew what he was doing. But he was famous for not having, the records were without bass. And so that got changed. Like Incense and Peppermints, you can barely hear the bass. And it's Ed playing on that. And then Ed was more in charge when it came time to record Tomorrow. And so the bass is real prominent.
And yeah, it's an important part of it.
And it's a real important part of it. It's really a good bass part.
Yeah.
And we used to craft our bass parts. Each song had its own... It wasn't like you just played the bass part to the chords. We used to craft the part. We had to come up with parts and figure out something that went with the song.
Right. Well, it's melodic, and I think that's important.
Yeah.
There were a few groups that were doing... I mean, McCartney, probably the most obvious, but... It's different, and it's a different sound than what was coming out of the music machine, so to speak, with the Wrecking Crew, because they did lines and stuff like that, but it wasn't like what you guys were doing. And I presume he was doing that, but you play fingers, you don't play pick.
I play fingers.
Yeah,
Ed used to get this sound like it was fingers,
but he played with a pick.
But he played with a pick always. And even now.
And what was that, a Fender bass? Or was he using...
He had a Fender bass, but he was using different things. There's a picture of him using the Vox bass in the studio.
Hmm.
And because he had a Vox hollow body. I forget what they're called, a Cougar or something.
Oh, yeah.
And it had a good sound to it in the studio. But mostly, I think he wanted to use Fender. I had a Echo bass on the first album and a Gibson on the second album, a Gibson EB3.
Yeah, the Echo's another one of those vintage.
Yeah.
I remember those guys. That's very cool. I see Howie pulled out the sitar, so I'm going to play a clip from... Actually, it's a newer clip from the 2012 album, though it's an older song, Sit with the Guru, which you have sitar guitar. So let me play that, and then I'm going to have you break it down, tell us what you're doing on this. Because there's two things I want to point out. There's a sitar guitar, and listen to the lead guitar when it goes to the regular lead. He's doing these little trills, and it sounds like that reed instrument that the snake charmer type of they do those drills. So I thought that was really cool because it kind of gives the flavor to the whole song. But take a listen to it and listen, and we'll talk a little bit because I want to know how you got that sound. It's an interesting... It sounds pretty reedy for a guitar.
Right. It's funny.
All right. So let me play the clip, and then we'll pick Howie's brains on this one. Here we go.
Nicely painted,
that guitar little thing that he's doing is just brilliant because it gets that. I know it's a guitar because I heard what you were playing before,
right.
But if I just heard that little excerpt, it's like it sounds
yeah,
like
you
that
don't
instrument.
Know what it is, yeah, yeah.
I always called it his backwards guitar.
Backwards guitar.
I always say, how we do that backwards guitar stuff.
Backwards guitar thing.
Well, now he's on a different. He's on the.
He's on the
different
sitar.
Guitar, but you know what? Let's briefly. Actually, Steve's playing the sitar part on this song. If there's a lick he does at the beginning when I play it, I'll throw it in there. He goes. When he comes in, it's really cool. But if you want me to switch guitars, I'll demo that sound, the bagpipe.
Right. Well, while you're
yeah.
switching, now this. Album that in 2012, obviously, to me it sounds like you're cranking up the amps. You're not using a distortion.
That was all live. There's definitely some fuzz and stuff.
Oh, you are using a distortion.
Yeah, that was definitely some sort of fuzz. I never can tell anybody what fuzz I use because I own so many that I just just grab the one that is closest to the door.
But it's interesting because you get this kind of a nasally type of sound. Which is indicative of that reed instrument, and then you're doing the trills on there.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny, the history of that. I first heard that sound and didn't know what it was. It was a Frank Zappa live thing. And he was, and I'm listening to him, I go, oh, that guy's a genius. How's he doing that? You know, he was doing something like, let's see, from too loud. You know, he was doing some lead, and he was going, But he was more. Adrian Ballou later on would do that, so it was more bagpipe guitar, and then holding it in, and that's I spent years kind of working on that. Sometimes I play better than normal, but here than others.
Right.
Between the two, and like that particular sound was even more fuzzy and mid-range and really.
But that's mainly the distortion. Like you didn't use like a wah to make it more nasally, or
right? There was no filtering or anything going on there. Yeah, it's just straight fuzz. Probably it might have two things. Let me just try. Here's going to be a lot louder. Hang on. Another trick I like to do is like just play very, like, baby, you're a rich man. You know, the little.
Yeah.
And just play, like, very randomly fast things, but staccato. It sounds kind of funny here, but when you bring it in and out in a mix.
In it's context like, with it, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what amp were you using?
That was, I think I was using like a Buddha, like it was like a, it's basically a copy of a Vox AC30.
Oh.
When we recorded at Steve's, that was a long time ago now, right, guys?
Yeah.
A while ago.
Okay, was that a 112 type of sound?
Yeah, 112.
It's a great sound.
Yeah, it's a nice sound, and that's what's nice about that record. That's pretty much, everybody's playing live. Steve and I were threatened to, we'll do the solos over again, and we didn't. We had like carpets all over the amps and all
we
over the room. It was crazy.
Both drum sets set up facing each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's pretty wild.
It was fun. It's amazing it came out as well as it did considering it. But
There's one little tidbit that we forgot to bring up on drums.
Mm-hmm.
So Gene is the drummer on Incense and Peppermints.
Okay.
That's right.
That's him.
Right.
Iconic.
And it's a distinctive thing. I mean, your sound, the way you set up the rhythm, is distinct.
Yeah.
To me, I think, which really I'm glad that they didn't have you use session players, that you guys got to play, because that sound that's part of the sound, the way the drums work. And then, again, you were saying that you do these arrangements and you carefully plan what you're doing.
Yeah.
It makes a difference because all of it works. You know what I mean? And the fills are unique to you. I mean, I think that when I listen to that, it's different that I'm trying to remember what I was hearing at the time, what was out, was on a radio, what was happening. And it was a different sound. And I think that's important to realize. I mean, we hear it. a lot of people hear it now and they've heard everything, and people have tried to bring back the 60s, and so it's been kind of rehashed and stuff, and they don't understand that at that time how unique it was.
Well, nothing was rehashed back then. Everything was experimental.
So right. It was all new.
It was
new.
Wide open.
Yeah. So it was hashing, not rehashing.
Yeah.
It was hashing. That's right.
I mean, no, now everybody says, oh, that sounds like back then. Yeah. There was very little of that because, first of all, we were trying to be different than everybody else. The right. whole idea was to have your own sound.
And right.
Gene, as a drummer, was coming out of the band The Sixpence, which is a band that I joined before we actually kind of morphed into the Strawberry Alarm Clock, where Gene was playing with Ed King and Lee Freeman and a few other guys, including myself, and they were already playing together, so Gene was comfortable in the studio just playing right. the same style he always did. Now, and then when Randy came in, Randy added a whole different flavor because he was bringing a jazz background. Randy could elaborate on that if you'd like, but his drumming immediately was noticed that it wasn't straight ahead rock and roll drumming
at right. all.
Randy was coming from a completely different background, and he was injecting that into the band, which added another flavor into the band that we had. And also, he plays vibraphones, which not too many other bands even had vibes in them.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. And Zappa used
He was trained, okay. you know. I mean, he was a good vibe player.
But have Gene grab the mic and Randy. What were you using drum wise on Incense and Peppermints?
It was a four piece Gretsch drums.
Gretsch, okay.
White Swirl.
White Swirl.
And then
White Swirl.
On the last cut that we played, what were you using on the 2012 album?
Tama drum
Tama set.
Yeah.
And then what were you using on, what are you using?
2012 or on, like, say, the second album?
The second album. The what you were using album, before and the then
first,
later.
The first album and second album was a Champagne Sparkle Gretsch, double bass.
So you guys were...
If I could interject it, the only record that I played on the first album was Incense and Peppermints, and Randy played on the rest of the album, Incense and Peppermints, as well as the next two albums or three albums?
Two albums.
Yeah. And then I came back to drums in 1969 on the Good Morning Starshine album.
Oh, okay. So, but it's predominantly a Gretsch sound. Now, you still use Gretsch, or what are you using now?
I was using Pearl for a long time after the Gretsch, and now I've got a new North, well, it's an old North set that I rebuilt. And I'm really enjoying the North set.
With a plethora of rototoms, right?
No.
I had the plethora of rototoms with the Pearl set.
Yeah.
In fact, before I came back with the group, I had a 40-piece rototom set contained three octaves. They were all halftones, and I was doing a lot of melodies.
A lot of melodic stuff.
Yeah. But now I'm really enjoying the North, and as far as that real high end, I've got a couple of Tito Puente timbales.
Mm-hmm.
To go that, but my 6-inch North is like a timbale thing. Here, it's,
yeah, those are interesting drums. Again, a lot of people they're not made anymore, so they don't realize the impact that those had. They were very, very, very cool.
I saw it when I went on to a percussion seminar for Remo and stuff with Billy Cobham, and he was backed by them.
Yeah,
and that's when I went. I just went. Oh,
those
I
are the ones that had that flared out.
Yeah, right? Like a bell of a horn.
So it looked like a little horn, but it yeah. basically sent all the sound out front.
Yeah,
so.
There's only a skin on one side.
Right.
Yeah,
right. But when you were recording back in the earlier days, did they use a lot of mics on it, or was it pretty minimal and you just got more of a room sound? And then also, too, on this 2012, how were you guys mic'd?
Basically, every tom-tom has a mic on it, basically.
Even back then?
They had
overheads.
It was overhead for sure, but they tried to get a better EQ on the toms.
Oh, okay.
At that time, at least our producer did, and Buff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they were using a lot of mics. So
yeah, I think on Incense and Peppermints, when we kind of rehearsed the song in the studio, he realized that there was only one tom-tom that I was using on the song. Mm-hmm. So he mic'd that one with the rest of the, but instead of mic'ing the floor tom-tom as predominant as they, you know, with the Mount Tom Tom, they made sure that that was mic'd well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But you, since you guys were playing live, I was wondering how much the engineer was playing with the leakage. Because a lot of times the leakage makes the sound. It's what's coming through the other mics.
Incense and Peppermints was only recorded in mono. Our producer didn't feel that the song should have been mixed in stereo, so we never had a stereo version of Incense and Peppermints, which was annoying. Several people have tried to come out with a simulated stereo. In fact, there is a few versions out there that you can find, but when they put Incense and Peppermints on the album, in the stereo album, they put a mono version in the left channel, and they put a mono version in the right channel.
So it's just two-channel mono.
Two-channel mono.
I'm surprised that you guys didn't try to redo it.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. We just did. And recently, in the last year, we re-recorded Incense and Peppermints. We're not 100% through with it or 100% happy with it yet. But at some point, we hope to re-release it. And
I want to hear that in stereo. That'll
yeah,
be cool.
Yeah,
that'll be good. Now I want to play one other little clip here. We're almost out of time. I told you guys it would go by fast, and I do want to play the Barefoot in Baltimore to take us out. But I want to play this. It's a small clip. It's about 30 seconds or so from a farmer, and it's, if I'm correct, it's Howie going nuts.
Oh yeah.
So you were saying, George was telling me that you guys had finished what you needed to do, and you guys left and let him just go crazy.
Well, Steve gave us a bunch of, Steve Bartek actually gave us some things that were laying around in his studio, like egg beaters and a bunch of different things. And he said, everybody play on Howie's guitar while he's doing this solo.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. And so
yeah, it was like those,
you mean
analog egg beaters and and I think I just held a chord or
you just held a chord.
That reminds me, Randy came up with playing on Randy and Mushroom Pillow on our first album. Randy came up with the idea to use his drumsticks on Ed King's guitar on the intro of the song. Mm-hmm. And Howie, for the longest time, thought it was like Ed King was like this genius.
He was a god. How did he play that intro?
Until I
went to my first rehearsal.
We still do it on stage today. Randy goes over to Howie's guitar player, Howie's Stratocaster, and he just starts taking his drumsticks and playing a little tune on his strings.
Yeah. Well, let me play the clip real quick.
Let's check
so
it
you
out.
Can hear what they did to his guitar.
Yeah, let's see what kind of crazy.
Actually, since you were mentioning it, because I know I'm rushing because I want to get everything in here.
Right.
Let me play the clip I have of the Rainy Day Mushroom Pillow. I don't think I have the intro, but let me play this for you, and you can tell me what's going on here.
Oh, it's going to be here.
That's it.
Well, that's Randy playing.
Very cool. So that was, that's an interesting sound. It's different. It actually sounds like another instrument. And that was the telly, right? That was his telly?
Yes, that was the telly.
Yes.
That was
his telly. Sounds like it.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's funny. I was actually a little worried about the first rehearsal. I go, I just can't get that sound, man. I don't think these guys are going to buy what I do.
Yeah, Ed switched over to an SG after that, a Gibson, shortly after that.
That's a very cool sound.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time. I told you we'd go by fast.
You're right.
I want to thank you guys for coming on the show, and we obviously, especially if you get that mix of incense and peppermints, we have to come back and just take a look at that.
No, Jeff.
So, but also too, I want to thank Lori for introducing all you guys and making
us. Hey, Lori.
Now, what's going on with the group?
It's a Strawberry Alarm Clock weekend. That's what's happening. I'll work backwards. Sunday, there's a double shot over at Bogey's in Westlake Village. There's a 6 o'clock and an 8 o'clock show, two different shows. And you can get tickets in advance through Eventbrite. We'll put the link up on your page, Jeff.
Okay.
And there's all kinds of event links on Facebook and Strawberry Alarm Clock pages and stuff. So you can find that there. And then, George, maybe you want to talk about the whiskey on Saturday.
The whiskey is Saturday.
Whiskey-A-Go-Go.
The Whiskey-A-Go-Go, Sunset Strip. It's a place that we've played quite a few times.
Since high school
days.
One thing we might mention about the whiskey show, we go on at around 11 o'clock. I know it's past everybody's bedtime.
It's past my bedtime, for sure.
But we have Robert Jacobs' Midnight Sunlight Show, which is an amazing light show that you won't see in any other club anywhere. And he has an original liquid light show going with his projection light show with the Wizard. Richard used to do San Francisco shows back in the 60s. So
The Iron Butterfly album cover was his work.
Yeah, so he's going to be there too. It's going to be both of them doing the light show orchestrated.
Oh, very, very cool.
To our songs.
You won't even be able to see us.
We're going
to
be doing
which is the idea.
And Jeff, we're going to be doing our first album. Almost in its entirety that night too. So the light show and the projection is all orchestrated out by Robert Jacobs.
Awesome.
Midnight Sunlight Show.
Very cool. Everybody check out strawberryalarmclock.com and you can see more pictures, all the bios on all the gang and everything like that. Thank you again. I'm going to leave with this clip, Barefoot in Baltimore, which actually became like the theme for Baltimore, right?
It went to number one there.
It went to yes, but it's a very cool. I think I have the. I cut the to the end, to take us out to the end of the song, so it fades out. But thank you, guys. We definitely have to do this again, and I really appreciate.
We'll get Steve on the next time too.
Yes, Steve had a last minute
Steve,
gig.
If you're listening right now, you're on the next show.
He should be busy working.
He's doing some dumb movie or something with John Bryan, whatever.
Well, when he comes next time, he has to bring the flute because we have.
Oh yeah, he's really good at that.
Sure.
Everybody, thank you so much. Everybody out there, have a great show.
Thank you.
And this is Barefoot in Baltimore.